Thank you very much, Rector, for those generous remarks. We're celebrating 650 years of medical history in Vienna and the 10th anniversary of the newly formed University of Vienna Medical School. If you look at the history of medicine in Vienna, particularly from Mrkatansky on, you can easily dissect out five major contributions to knowledge that derive from Mrkatansky and from the Second Vienna School of Medicine. The first is, as you heard, the foundation of scientific medicine. The second is the discovery that all mental processes originate in the brain, an abolition of dualism. Three, the appreciation that psychiatric processes also, of course, derive from the brain, which led to the foundation of modern psychiatry. Fourth, the discovery of unconscious mental processes. And most astonishing of all, the development of a modern post-Darwinian thought. This is probably the first time in intellectual history in which a medical movement influenced popular culture and stimulated a new way of thinking about life and the human mind. So let me begin with the foundations of scientific medicine. It's hard to begin to believe that at the beginning of the 18th century, European medicine was in large part pre-scientific. It was only in the aftermath of the French Revolution that a reorganization of the university occurred. Basic scientists were encouraged to look at clinical problems, and in Paris, a medical school developed that tried to get a more scientific approach to medicine. The stethoscope, which was discovered in Vienna, was really first applied in a systematic way by French physicians in Paris in order to try to understand what was going on in the heart and the chest. However, this enthusiastic beginning sort of faded out around 1840 with the July monarchy and the conservatism that was introduced into academic life, and the intellectual energy moved from Paris to the German-speaking countries, and particularly to Austria and to the University of Vienna and to the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus. Maria Theresia realized that the medical services provided to a people were very modest. Moreover, if you wanted to have an effective army, you needed to have a medical corps to take part of the army. So she brought Gerhard von Sweden from Holland, an experimentally oriented physician, to come to Vienna. And as you heard, he introduced taking a very careful clinical history from the patient. Her son, Joseph II, established the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus in 1784, and that was an extraordinary advance. The Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus was a general hospital. It was distinctive from other general hospitals in several ways. Number one, it belonged to the University of Vienna Medical School, so it had very high academic standards, and the medical school was part of the university. So it was really an academic extension of the University of Vienna, which was really a great university in the middle of the 18th century. Moreover, it had several unusual features to it. It had a rule that everyone who died in the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus had an autopsy. This was probably the first time this was generally established as a policy for every single patient who died to have an autopsy. And even more unique, every autopsy was done by a single person, the head of pathology. The reason this was important is because in French-speaking hospitals, in Yugoslavian-speaking, Serbian hospitals, and many other hospitals, English-speaking hospitals, each physician did his own autopsy. So there was not a systematic correlation of the autopsies being performed within the hospital. This was not the case in Vienna General Hospital. All the autopsies were performed by one person. And this really became important when, in 1844, when Karl von Mrkatansky became head of pathology. Mrkatansky realized before you can make a diagnosis, you really have to understand what's going on, and you certainly don't want to treat before you have a diagnosis, otherwise you may be treating incorrectly. But the point was, one couldn't really make accurate diagnoses in his time, in the 1850s. And he felt that the problem was the following. When one listened to a patient, for example, with a stethoscope, which is available there, you heard sounds coming from the heart, and you heard sounds coming from the lung, but you didn't know what they meant. You didn't know, is this the normal opening of the mitral valve, or is it mitral stenosis? Is this the normal functioning of the aortic valve, or is it aortic insufficiency? What does the peculiar sounds from the lung mean? Does this mean pneumonia? Does it mean cancer of the lung? So he realized that in order to understand what those sounds means, what the clinical history and the physical examination means, you need to correlate what is happening at the bedside with what you find at autopsy in case the patient dies. So he recruited as his colleague Joseph Skoda, an extraordinary clinician. After a while, people stormed from all over Europe and even the United States to work with Skoda. He was such a great clinician. He would take a superb history. He would do a careful physical examination, describe in detail the sounds that he heard from the heart and the lung. And if the patient died, he and Rokitansky together would do the autopsy, and they would see what these sounds were due to. And if they had any question whether the peculiar sound he heard was from a stenosed mitral valve, they would run fluid through the mitral valve to see whether they could simulate the sounds they would heard. This was really an extraordinary accomplishment, and it put medicine for the first time on a scientific basis. So let me summarize Rokitansky's contribution. I want to begin by his scientific contributions, because that's only one of the several contributions he made. He transformed medicine from a natural philosophy to a modern clinical discipline through systematic clinical pathological correlations. He emphasized the principle that the truth is often hidden below the surface. You have to look deep in order to understand what's going on. And this is a metaphor that he projected throughout the public. He became not only the leader of the medical school, he was elected to parliament, he was a spokesman for science, and he told everyone who wanted to listen that it's often difficult in science to find out the truth unless you dig deeply. And this had a great influence on Freud, as we'll see in a little while. He provided some of the principles of modern clinical investigations, that research is inseparable from teaching at the university hospital. The university hospital is nature's laboratory. And he also developed many of the subspecialties. Before that, many medical schools did not have departments of dermatology, ophthalmology, otolaryngology. Here they began to develop this, and he had many outstanding people that he taught. I only list a few of them: Semmelweis, von Heber, Meinert, and Freud. But he was also a very important spokesman for freedom of science and freedom of the medical school. He felt very strongly, coming from Bohemia itself, that a medical school ought to accept people for their excellence, not for their ethnic or religious background. And he championed what had long been standing, one of the Austrian traditions. There was also, you know, a racist Austrian tradition, but he supported the Austrian tradition where medical education was based on excellence, not on, you know, who your parents were. Even after Rokitansky's death, his position was strongly defended by the people that identified with him. And this was in contrast to Theodor Billroth, who's an extremely interesting man. Billroth was without question the most important surgeon of his time. He introduced excisions of tumors, surgical operations on the internal organs of the body. And Billroth was captured for the University of Vienna by Rokitansky. He brought him here from a German university. It was considered a great coup, and strengthened the medical school a great deal. He was an extraordinary scientist, but he was also a racist. He felt that there was a German nationality and that had to be reflected in a German national character of medicine. And he particularly objected to Eastern European Jews coming and going to the medical school. And he wrote a very racist book, über das Lehren und Lernen der medizinischen Wissenschaft an den Universitäten der deutschen Nation. This caused a scandal among the liberal Rokitansky contingent at the University of Vienna, but it laid a seed which was to repeat itself periodically in the later history, particularly in the 38 period, where there always was a racist tradition within Austrian medicine. Let me come to the second contribution of the Vienna School of Medicine, the discovery that all mental processes originate in the brain. This came from Franz Josef Gall, who brought an end to Cartesian dualism. Until around 1800, most people believed that the brain only controlled the reflexes of the body, you know, what you use when you swim, what you use when you hit a backhand in tennis. It didn't control thinking, loving, creating, you know, learning and remembering things. Those were issues of the mind, and the mind was extracorporeal. It was not part of the body. It was part of a soul. Gall came along and said, that is sheer nonsense. All mental functions are biological, and they come from the brain. Mowry said, there must be a distribution of functions. They can't all be carried out by all parts of the brain. So different regions of the brain must carry out different biological functions. So it suggested that different mental functions are localized to different regions of the brain. Now, how did he localize them? He knew that there were four lobes to the brain, the frontal, the parietal, the temporal, and occipital, but he knew that each one of us has more than four behavioral capabilities. So he realized that he needed to explain the psychology of its day, 35 odd regions to mediate these functions. So he divided the brain into three major areas: the intellectual functions at the front of the brain, the emotional functions at the back of the brain, like amativeness, romantic love, parental love, and in between he had sentiments, hope, sublimity, acquisitiveness. Now, how did he determine that this area in the front of the brain is involved in comparison and this region at the back of the brain is involved in amativeness and romantic love? But it's very simple. He said, when you use a particular part, you, for example, if a very attractive young woman, if you use your romantic skills effectively, the back of your brain, that part of the brain, will swell because of growth of new synaptic connections, and it will push in the skull. So the back of your skull will come out. If, like the rector, you're highly intelligent, you're thinking all the time, making major decisions about policy, then the front of the brain enlarges, it pushes on the forehead, and as you can see, he has a very prominent forehead. This man must obviously be very intelligent. So this created a rage. People would start feeling each other's foreheads because they were so impressed with Gall. So he found that the smart students in his class had, very much like the rector, a prominent forehead, while the shallow thinkers had a shallow forehead. And what he thought was that regions of comparison, making intellectual decisions, they swelled up and they pushed the skull in front of them. Similarly, as I pointed out, with romantic love, women who were very attractive and practiced romantic love had a prominent back of the head. Those that didn't had a shallow back of the head. And that's because the amativeness of reason swelled. I cannot tell you the impact this made, and where do you think it made the greatest impact? What is your guess? What country in the world? The United States, of course. They love stuff like this. You could not get married in the United States without having your head thoroughly palpated. No other part of the body really counted. But the French were more skeptical. And Marie-Jean-Pierre Florence, a great experimental neuroanatomist, said, what's the experimental evidence for this? So he did an experiment. He took cats and dogs and removed the amativeness region from the back of the head. This is the region that contains the cerebellum, so they had some motor difficulty, but no difficulty whatsoever in making love. In fact, he felt they made love better after this region was removed than before. Let me turn to the person who began to put the anatomical localization on a solid footing, and gave rise to the foundation of modern psychiatry. Theodor Meinert, a person who is undervalued for his contribution, really enormous contribution. He founded modern psychiatry and he did it here in Vienna. He studied the cerebral cortex in great detail. He was responsible for what we call cytoarchitectonics. Different areas of the brain have different constituents of major cells and very characteristic ones. And moreover, he emphasized the fact that not only mental functions, but mental disorders come from the brain. So he wrote in his classic textbook, Clinical Treatise on the Disease of the Forebrain, that the reader will find no other definition of psychiatry in this book but the one given on the title page. And then he said, the historical term for psychiatry, that is the treatment of the soul, implies more than we can accomplish and transcends the bounds of accurate scientific investigation. He was enormous, and he also influenced a lot of people, including the next person I'm going to speak to, Sigmund Freud, who discovered unconscious mental conflicts. Now, Sigmund Freud is, to my mind, one of the extraordinary scholars of the Vienna School of Medicine. And many of his contributions are not appreciated because they occurred before he became a psychoanalyst. But when he entered the medical school, he fell in love with basic science research. He worked with Meinert, he worked with other people, and he carried out research, which I really admire a great deal. He was the first person to show that invertebrate nerve cells, the nerve cells of flies, of snails, of worms, are exactly homologous to the nerve cells in your brain and mine. So there was no distinction between mental processes. Of course, there's a distinction. There's no distinction between the elements that mediate psychological processes in snails and in people. Of course, people can mediate many, many processes that snails cannot even come close to doing it. And he wanted to make this his career. But he was soon informed of the fact that in those days you could not make a career in science at the University of Vienna unless you had a private income. He did not have a private income. He wanted to get married to Martha Benes. They wanted to have children. So he realized, as someone told him very clearly, he had to go into private practice. So first he thought about neurology, which was very close to what he was doing. And in fact, he wrote a very good book on cerebral palsy, and he wrote a superb book on aphasia, outstanding classics that are still read to this day, okay? But he decided there are a lot of neurologists in Vienna, and he didn't think he would really be able to find a niche for himself. And also, he was very much influenced by a senior colleague, a student of Rokitansky, by the name of Breuer. I should point out that Freud also was a student of Rokitansky. In the day of Rokitansky, you could not give a scientific seminar without the dean, which he was at that time, being present and signing off satisfactorily on the presentation. And Freud presented twice with Rokitansky in a room, and both times he got very good grades. When Rokitansky died, Freud went to the funeral and wrote to friends what a tragic loss this is for Austrian medicine and for me personally, because he was such an inspiring figure on so many levels. And when Freud died, several obituaries mentioned that he trained at the University of Vienna Medical School, that he was influenced by Rokitansky, and they said, isn't this a good thing that he was in the influence of Rokitansky? Because psychoanalysis is such a speculative science. Imagine where it would have gone if he didn't have Rokitansky to hold it back. How did he get interested in psychoanalysis? He got interested in psychoanalysis through Breuer. Breuer from the Herring-Breuer reflex was very close to Rokitansky. And he went into sort of neurology and psychiatry, and he saw a patient by the name of Anna O, who had a hysterical paralysis of her right arm. Now, why did he think he was hysterical? Well, he did careful neurological examination. He found absolutely nothing wrong. So he began to talk to her, and he also began to put her into hypnosis because Charcot had found that patients with hysterical paralysis respond well to hypnotic therapy. But in addition to hypnosis, he found that he was talking to her and she was talking back to him. So free association was discovered by Breuer. And while they were talking to each other, she described that her father often liked to rest his head on her arm as he became older and frail. And it was in this position that he died. And while he was lying in this position, she would have positive feelings, she would have negative feelings about him. And when he died, she began to feel very guilty about these feelings, and she developed this hysterical paralysis. And as she talked about this, this gradually cleared up as she understood what was underlying it. Freud, who heard all of this on a daily basis from Breuer, because they were very close friends, was fascinated with it and decided he wanted to explore this himself. He went to France, to Paris, studied with Charcot, came back, picked up, started to do the same kind of thing, very rapidly dropped the hypnosis and just carried on doing free associations. Soon after it got going with the free associations, he wanted to tie this back to biology. He had very strong biological roots, and he wanted to develop a biological basis of psychoanalytic thought in 1895. Now, if you try to develop a biological basis of psychoanalytic thought in 2014, you would be nowhere near succeeding. But to do it in 1895 was, you know, delusionally optimistic. He wrote a 15-page essay on this, extremely difficult for me to understand. He has a diagram of how repression works that I reproduce in my book on art and science, and it took me 2 weeks to do a fair job in stating in modern comprehensible terms what Freud was trying to say. He realized that this was hopeless. He never published in his lifetime. He put in a drawer, but when he died, almost everything he wrote was published by Anna Freud and by Ernst Chris, and this is how the public came about this. So he gave up on biology, and he developed a systematic psychoanalysis. He took the patient's observable behavior, the patient's symptom and normal behavior, and described what was conscious and unconscious in the mental processes going on, and developed a theory, psychoanalysis, that sort of organized this in a schematic way. And all the time, throughout his career, he said, someday, biology is going to come along and it's going to falsify many of these ideas. Biology is going to be the true basis in which psychoanalysis can be built. And this is something I very strongly believe in. So it's ridiculous to try to summarize Freud's cognitive psychology in three ideas, but that's never stopped me in the past, it won't stop me now. He said human beings are not rational creatures, they're driven by irrational, unconscious mental processes. That adult character, including unconscious sexuality and aggression, can be traced to the mind of a child. And that no mental event occurs by chance. This is really a profound insight. He said there is no noise in the machine. Everything the patient tells you is connected to some other thing the patient tells you. Free association makes sense. So mental events adhere to scientific laws and they follow the principles of psychic determinism. As a result of this contribution, Freud has emerged as the major source of a modern Rokitanskian inclination to look for meaning beneath the surface of behavior. I'm going to come back to Freud in a little while, but this is all I will say at this point. The fifth contribution of the Vienna School of Medicine, and the most remarkable, is it didn't just stay in the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus. It diffused throughout the coffee houses of Vienna, it diffused throughout the other faculties, and had an enormous impact on modern thought. Let me put this into perspective for you. Modernist thought began in the mid-19th century as part of a response to the restrictions and hypocrisies of everyday life, but even more as a reaction to the Enlightenment of the 18th century and its excessive emphasis on the rationality of human behavior. The Enlightenment Age of Reason was characterized by the belief that humans were specially created by God as rational creatures that differed from all other living creatures by having their actions guided by reason. These Enlightenment beliefs were inspired by the extraordinary success of the scientific revolution of the 16th, 17th century. It was argued that the success of this revolution derived from the application of reasoned thinking to the study of the universe by great rational minds, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. This led to the formation in 1660 of the Royal Society, of which Newton, who was an early member, became president in 1703. The founders of the society thought of God as a mathematician who designed the universe to operate according to logical mathematical principles. I should assure those of you in the audience who may not be familiar with it, this is not the Jewish definition of God. The function of the scientist was to decipher the code book God had created, had used to create the universe. This perspective led to the belief that we live in a rational world in which reason and enlightened thought would ultimately lead to better conditions for all humankind. In reacting to the Enlightenment, modernism represented a search for new worldview, a view importantly provided by Charles Darwin. Darwin is extraordinary. He said humans are not uniquely created, but biological creatures that have evolved from simple animal ancestors. That evolution is driven by sexual selection, so that from an evolutionary perspective, the primary function of a biological organism is to reproduce itself. Since sexual attraction and mate selection are central to the behavior of all animals, sex must be central to human behavior. This is 30 or 40 years before Freud. A key to sexual attraction, mate selection, and indeed to all social intervention is facial expressions and the emotion that it mediates. This is something I'm going to return to later on in considering art. Think of your face, face of the people that you know, face of the people next to you. Most of your response to them is determined, initially at least, by the facial expressions that you confront. Darwin realized this and actually wrote at length about this. Modernism has many roots, but the Viennese modernism, which created the world we live in today, the Age of Insight, had three features which characterize how we think today. A view of the human mind as not being rational, but driven by unconscious sexual aggressive drives. The conviction that the search for the rules that govern the nature of the human mind begins with an examination of oneself. And a broad attempt to integrate and unify knowledge, an attempt driven by science. So this again, Vienna, because it was small, but in 1900, intellectually very intense, brought in cafe houses and salons, brought together scientists with artists, with economists, with business people, and allowing an exchange of ideas was rare in any other part of Europe. One example of an attempt to integrate different areas of knowledge was the initiation of a dialogue between art and science, a dialogue helped not only by the artists, but by a great school of art history that was here that I'm going to come to in a few moments. So the dialogue relating art to science that originated in modernist thought of Vienna 1900 had three phases. One, the independent discovery in Vienna of different aspects of unconscious mental processes by two physicians, Freud and Schnitzler. I only spoke about Freud, but Schnitzler described women's sexual life in enormous detail, and he documented every single orgasm he had. Let me tell you, a lot of numbers were involved there. But also insights into unconscious mental processes came from three modernist artists, Klim, Kokoschka, and Schiele. Now, all of them, of course, were living in a Freudian atmosphere, but Kokoschka in particular felt, I discovered the unconscious independently of Freud. I'm not so sure of that, but I'm just quoting him. And they all were, as I will show you, influenced by common source, Karl von Mercatansky. The first attempt to bridge art and science, the science being psychology, was made by three Viennese art historians, Riegel, Chris, and Gombrich, to a focus on the beholder's share. And a further bridging of art and science is occurring now, an attempt to bring brain biology to understanding what is the nature of the beholder's share. And I'm going to try to take you through each of these three phases. Let me begin with the first phase, medical science and art. Let me tell you again what Freud did. He realized that human beings are not rational creatures, they're driven by irrational unconscious mental processes, that adult character, including unconscious sexuality and aggression, can be traced to the mind of a child, that no mental events occur by chance, mental events adhere to scientific laws and follow the principles of psychic determinism. And as a result of his contribution, Freud emerged as the major source of a modern Rokitanskian inclination to look for meaning beneath the surface of behavior. But Freud missed certain things. He simply didn't understand certain things. that the Viennese monists intuitively or experimentally understood. And one of the major things about Freud, he had no insight into female sexuality. Now, if you like over drink, I can explain to you why this was so. But the fact is, he thought that women did not enjoy sex. They suffered from the fact that they didn't have a penis. They engaged in sex to please their husband, to have children, hopefully that they would have male children because the male chin would have a penis. Really absurd ideas about female sexuality. But take somebody like Klimt, who slept with anywhere from 3,500 to 4,000 women. He knew an enormous amount about female sexuality. Moreover, he was very much influenced by Rodin, whom he met in Vienna through Bertha Zucker Kandel. Rodin did not ask his models to pose for him. Rodin said, don't pose for me. Just hang around the studio, do whatever you want, and when I'm interested, I'll draw you, okay? And Klimt followed the same lead. He told his models, do whatever you want. And after all, this is Vienna, very sophisticated place. The models, after a while, got bored, so they began to, you know, couple with other models that were there, female models. They might have sex with a guy who came into the studio. They might masturbate. And when he was interested, he would draw them. Not in a pornographic way, in the most delicate, sensitive, insightful fashion. So, for example, he would show women masturbating with delicacy, with thoughtfulness, with grace, that were just really superb drawings. You have to realize how revolutionary this is in the history of Western art by comparison. The nude has been repeatedly done in Western art by some of the greatest artists, Giorgione, Titian, Goya, Manet. And it had characteristic features, the nude. Number one, they were mythological creatures. Venus, Maya, Olympia. Never the girl next door. Number two, the nude looked at the beholder, usually a male, as if her only function in life was to please a prurient male beholder. And three, if you look very carefully, you will see in one, two, three of the examples, the woman has her left hand over a pubic region. Now you don't know, is this modesty or is she masturbating? If you look at Klimt, there's never a moment's hesitation. You know exactly what's going on. But I think even more remarkable, Klimt realized that not only do women have an erotic drive that's every bit as strong as that of men, but like men, they confuse aggression with sexuality. And what I think is Klimt's greatest painting is Judith and Holofernes. Now, many of you may know the story of Judith and Holofernes. Judith is a modest 24-year-old widow living in Bethula, which is a small town near Jerusalem. When the Assyrians placed a siege around Jerusalem, they also placed a siege around Bethula, and this was led by a commander called Holofernes. This siege was terrible. After 2 or 3 weeks, the town was in horrible shape. No one was taking the garbage away. There was a shortage of food. There was a shortage of washing material. So Judith felt she had to do something to save her people. So she took a housekeeper, and they snuck out between the troops forming the siege, and she searched out Holofernes, and she found that he was celebrating, having a nice Grunewitlina, something like that. And she encouraged him to drink more, and he did, got a little bit drunk. She encouraged him to take her to his tent, which he did with pleasure. And there she encouraged him to have sex with her, which he did. And after sex and drink, he was exhausted, he fell asleep. She took a sword off the wall and chopped off his head. This has been repeatedly depicted in Western art. This horrible deed, this woman sacrificing herself for her people, doing this act she could never think of doing under other circumstances. This is not Klimt's depiction. This is a woman in a post-coital trance, wearing Wiener Werkstätte dresser, exposed at the breast, and fondling the isolated head of Holofernes. This is an extraordinary painting and really shows you both the sexual and aggressive power of women, and I'm going to come back to women because I like women, so I'm going to explain how this comes about in biological terms later on. But I'm making the argument that Rokitansky influenced all of these people. How did he do it? How did he influence Klimt, for example? Well, he influenced Klimt through Zuckerkandel, of course. All of you know this. One of his colleagues, one of Rokitansky's colleagues, was Emil Zuckerkandel, a great anatomist. Structure, the Zuckerkandel organ, part of the autonomic nervous system, is named after him. He was a great anatomist, a very fine guy, who was married to Bertha Zuckerkandel. Bertha Zuckerkandel came from a very literary, intellectual family, and she started a salon. And in that salon, she brought together artists and writers and business people, deans of medical schools, all kinds of people, and they all talked to one another. She said, "On my diva, Vienna comes alive." And here, Klimt met Emil Zuckerkandel, and he got interested in biology. And there were four volumes of Darwin in Klimt's library when he died. Now, how many of you have four volumes of Darwin? Okay, Klimt began to read in biology. He began to go to Zuckerkandel's lecture. He began to look into the microscope. And wow, cells, aren't cells nifty? Aren't they interesting to look at? And he particularly liked Klimt being Klimt, sperm cells and egg cells. Not surprising, given his biological background. And you can see this, for example, in this wonderful painting of Zeus coming to Diana in a shower of golden raindrops. You see the golden raindrops, you see Diana, but if you look very carefully, you see this rectangular symbol. Do you all see that? That rectangular symbol is sperm for Klimt. Whenever you think of that, you realize that he is depicting sperm. You look at the other side of her, you see this circular structure. These are ova, fertilized ova. So Diana is a reproductive machine. She converts sperm into fertilized ova. You can see this in a number of his paintings. This is the famous The Kiss. If you look at the man, you see that his garment is decorated by sperm. Hers is decorated by ova. What was wonderful about Klimt was not only that he was a great lover of women, that he was a great artist, but he was amazingly supportive of his younger colleagues, even though they would break with his tradition of paintings. With the exception of his drawings, which are quite naturalistic, Klimt's paintings are really very romantic, very decorative, and not very insightful into the character of the person, with very rare exceptions, Judith being an exception. Kokoschka started off like this, and if you look, for example, in Die Traumende Knabe, this book that he wrote for children, you see very much a Klimt-like style. But soon he broke away, influenced by Munch and by Van Gogh. He began to paint as an expressionist artist in which there was very little decoration. The background was colors that he brought in to bring out emotion, not to depict reality. Moreover, he thought that I want to understand not the surface characteristics of somebody, but I want to understand deep what's going on in their head. And in order to do that, I have to study myself first. If you're going to have insight into other people, you must first have insights into yourself. And I should point out, this is Freud's point of view. The interpretation of dreams has a lot of interpretations of Freud's own dreams. And at the end of each session, each day, at the end of each day of therapy, he would spend a half an hour just analyzing himself. That would be very helpful for me also. I just don't have a half an hour at the end of each day. But anyway, Freud made that time so he could analyze himself. Kokoschka began by analyzing himself. This was just after he broke up with Alma Mahler. Throughout the whole episode with Alma Mahler, he felt, she's going to leave me. He was absolutely sure. But she was such a source of inspiration. She so uplifted his art. She did this for everyone that she had an affair with, that he really very much wanted to marry her. But not only did he not marry her, but she became pregnant with his child, and she aborted, and he was heartbroken. So he painted this picture of himself as if he's on the verge of a nervous breakdown. You see him with fingertips red, sucking his fingertips, extremely insecure, and the colors have nothing to do with natural colors. It's just designed to bring out his emotional state, which is sort of gray and blue. If any of you have been to Basel and seen The Tempest by Kokoschka, you see this little boat at sea. There is Anamala sleeping away, dreaming of Gropius, God knows, fearful, and he is ready to jump over because he knows what's going on in her mind. The amazing thing about Kokoschka is that he said, if I paint somebody's painting and I work with them for a week and I look at them for several hours each day for a week, I can tell their future. I really know what their life is going to be like. And he was very fortunate. Adolf Loos, the famous architect, got interested in Kokoschka early in his career. And he went around and he spoke to people like the world. If you're a very famous guy, you should have Kokoschka do your painting. If you don't like it, I'll take it back. He said this to everybody, okay? So he approached August Ferrel, the very famous psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at the University of Zurich, and he said, August, you deserve to have a painting by Kokoschka. You don't like it, I'll take it back. So Kokoschka painted it. Took him 2 weeks to do it. In the evening he came, after dinner they worked for a couple of hours. And when it was over, the family rejected it. They didn't like it. They said, look, the two eyes are not symmetrical. And look at his right hand. It droops. It looks like he had a stroke. We don't like it. Loos took it back, sold it to a museum. 2 months later, Loos had an identical stroke. We don't know what accounts for that, but it is not infrequent that before people have a major stroke, they have an ischemic episode in which the vessels that are ultimately shut down completely are shut down transiently, and you see the manifestations of these symptoms. The third of these artists is Egon Schiele. Egon Schiele is remarkable. He really represents the existential anxiety of everyday life. A lot of his pictures are really filled with tremendous anxiety. But in addition, he was very interested in himself. Very unusual. Klimt never did a self-portrait. In fact, he never did a portrait of a man. Kokoschka did several self-portraits. Schiele did 100 self-portraits in a 2-year period. He felt that the only way he could explain life to you was to explain it through movements of his own body. And he did this in the most shocking and provocative ways possible. So, as I said before, 100 over a 2-year period. And he used very artificial poses that, you know, he had seen by Charcot would bring out in patients and hypnosis. And most of these were in the nude because he felt he needed his whole body to demonstrate this. And he did this in the most provocative way. He painted himself masturbating. He had to outdo Klimt, of course. People were shocked by this. And this, of course, raised the question, what was Schiele trying to accomplish by being so provocative and so confrontational? And I think those of people who study him have come to a quite clear conclusion, which I have myself independently reached, that he wanted to change how society views the artist. This is a position that first came up with Velázquez. Before Velázquez, the reason you bought a painting was not because somebody important painted it, because you were interested in the subject of the painting. So if they painted you, the reason somebody bought the painting is because they wanted a painting of you. Velázquez, in his painting, in which he is painting the royal family, this is his canvas. The royal family standing to the right. You can see in the mirror the royal family standing. And this is the princess. But that's not the important thing. What he's saying is the reason you're buying this and the reason this is the most important painting in Western art is because I'm defining for you what's really important in the painting is that I, Velázquez, did this. And this is what Schiele did. He redefined the role of the artist, reinforcing Velázquez's argument. The second phase is, what is the psychology and the biology behind this? How do we respond to works of art? And here again, Vienna made a fantastic set of contributions. And it turns out Alois Riegel, who is the hero of this section of this talk, knew better than Zicke Kandel, and they both were great defenders of Klimt. Alois Riegel said, art history is going to die unless it becomes scientific. And science, in order to relate itself to, is psychology. And the problem it ought to confront is the beholder's share. A painting is not complete unless somebody responds to it. Now, this is obvious as hell, but no artist or anyone ever said that. The painter paints the painting. That's half the job. The other half is to have somebody respond to it. The great challenge for psychology of art is to understand the beholder's share, how the beholder responds to a work of art. This was picked up by two of his later students, Ernst Chris and Ernst Gombrich. Ernst Chris, who later became a psychoanalyst, I knew very well. He influenced me to become a psychoanalyst. And Ernst Gombrich, who I knew very slightly, I met him through Ernst Chris. Ernst Gombrich said, look, if you and I look at the same painting, we see it somewhat differently. Why is that so? Well, great works of art are slightly ambiguous, so we see different things in it. Also, you and I have different experience with art, different personal experience. We bring those to bear on the work of art. So that's interesting, Chris said. If that's true, if I'm seeing something different than you, then you and I are undergoing creative experiences, making up our own image of what we see in the canvas. That means the beholder is undergoing a creative process that in a very, very modest form recreates the creative process of the artist. Now that's a wonderful insight, because every one of you knows when you play with ideas, Siggy, you must have this experience all the time. When you play with ideas, anytime you see combinations with them, it gives you a great deal of pleasure. That's what keeps people in science. And he realized this is what's happening. So the beholder undergoes a creative process of their own. Gombrich went wild with this. He said, let's try to understand the nature of the visual perceptual process. He began to read about this. Very famous paper by Bishop Berkeley, George Berkeley, in which he pointed out the interesting thing. And when I look at an image, I look at the knee sitting there, the image that it casts on my retina is inadequate to give me a reconstruction of a face. The photons, which is all my retina sees, that come from my face, do not give me a veridical and accurate reconstruction of a face. I need additional information in order to see that this is Denise. But I tell you, every one of you sees Denise pretty much the way I see you. So we are all really benefiting from the two sources of information. Helmholtz called this bottom-up and top-down. Bottom-up information is what you're born with. You're born with a visual system that can function in Vienna 2014. You know, millions of years of evolution until, you know, the human mind really functions in a mature way. So when you're born, you can immediately recognize objects, you can recognize people. This is built into the visual system. If you see a source of light, you assume it's above because the eternal source of light is the sun, it's above us. If you see one person much taller than the other, you assume that person is closer to you than the other. This is built into your brain. But in addition, there are top-down processes. We all live in somewhat different worlds. We interact with different people. We have different experiences in art. And they influence how we judge something. So how attractive you find Denise in part depends on your personal associations, your personal experiences. Gombrich was fascinated by this, began to do experiments. And he said, if this is true, if in fact the bottom-up process is built into the system, it must take some guesses. On some situations that are ambiguous, it might take guesses. And that's the way to show what's really going on. That you sometimes can show that there is not veridical reconstruction. And he played with different kinds of games. I'll just show you one of them. Here there are four white circles, and superimposed upon them is a beautiful outlined black square. Do you all see that? Can the people in the back see it? Can you raise your hand if you see it? Everybody in the front also, raise your hand. You all see it. Nonsense! You are making this up. This is a complete illusion. If you rotate these white disks, you see that these are not complete disks. They are cutout disks. When they're arranged in this fashion, you in your brain make up these lines. They're not there at all. So you are taking guesses all the time. You don't really know what your partner looks like. You're filling it in. And thank God you're filling it in. So, Christian Gombrich built a three-stage hierarchy, very much like Freud did, and ended up by saying, sooner or later, we need to get into the brain and see what's happening to the beholder share. And this is the challenge that confronts us now. And this is what I want the young people in the audience to pay attention to, because I think this medical school is in a fabulous position with to begin to explore the bridge between art and science in this level. And I'll just give you some examples. So we want to understand what are the brain mechanisms underlying the beholder share. Now, what I've focused in on is just portraiture, particularly faces. How do we respond to faces? What goes on in the brain when we look at faces? Now, we can, in fact, define a simplified neural circuit of the beholder share for portraiture, for faces, the biological mechanisms. We look at another person's face, we analyze the facial contours. We have a representation of the face. There are areas of the brain that represent the face, and I'll show you can record from single cells that respond to your face. Similarly, there are representations of the body, both the body stationary and the body in motion. There are also parts of the brain that respond to simulation. So if you see somebody undergoing a certain movement, often you feel that movement. If you look at a statue, you often feel certain movement in your own body. In addition, there are psychological responses. If you're interacting with a portrait as you interact with a person, you often try to understand what's going on in that person's mind. This is what Kokoschka loved to do. What's going on inside their head? This is called theory of mind. This is an area that is defective in people with autism, who can interact on many levels but don't quite understand that you are a different person than I am. You have different aspirations and different goals. Let me just give you a couple examples of this. Representation of faces. As Darwin first pointed out, faces are essential for social interactions. We recognize others and even ourselves by means of the face, and we use the face to communicate emotion and to find a partner. Faces are treated differently by the brain than any other object in the body. There's a larger representation in the brain for faces than for anything else. Computers that have enormous mathematical capability have great difficulty in recognizing faces, while we do it with enormous facility. Young children can recognize 1,000 different faces. Moreover, if you put them in a monkey colony, leave them there for some time, they can recognize the difference between hundreds of different monkeys as unique individuals. Moreover, if this is a Rembrandt self-portrait, if you make a good drawing of that, I'm not sure, yes, you can see it quite well here. You can see that the drawing, particularly if it's exaggerated, reveals the person even more. We respond to cartoons of President Obama or Golda Meir or anybody else better than a photograph of these leaders. Moreover, there's something very interesting about faces. You have a difficult time recognizing faces upside down. If I take this bottle and turn it upside down, I might spill the water, but you recognize the bottle. But faces upside down, you have a difficult time with. Now, since this is Vienna and all of you are knowledgeable, you might recognize that this is the Mona Lisa, Leonardo's great painting of an enigmatic woman hanging in the Louvre. But you probably will not recognize that these are quite different images. Here is the enigmatic Mona Lisa, and here's a distorted image. Upside down, you can't tell it. And if it's not such a familiar face, you wouldn't recognize it at all. Now, what about the specific areas involved in face recognition? In 1947, a German neurologist, Joachim Bademer, realized that the inferior temporal lobe is important for face recognition. So this is where visual information comes in, at the back of the brain. It feeds into the posterior and anterior temporal cortex, the anterior inferior, posterior inferior. If you have a lesion here, you don't recognize a face as a face. Oliver Sacks' famous story of the man who mistook his wife for a hat, where a woman takes her husband to a physician to have him examined, and when the examination is over, he tries to pick her up and put it on his head because he thinks it's his hat. That's a posterior lesion. You don't recognize a face qua face. If you have a lesion in the anterior inferior cortex, you recognize a face qua face, but you have difficulty recognizing who it is. 10% of the people in this audience have some degree of facial agnosia in this way. It's called prosopagnosia, because many people are born with this. So you have slight difficulty, it varies in degree. Chuck Close, one of the great portrait artists of our time, is face blind. Has to take a photograph of the person he paints, put paper over it, and begin from there. Now the amazing thing is that the first person to really do systematic work on visual perception was trained at the University of Vienna Medical School. He left because he was socialist and in part Jewish. Steve Kuffler went to Australia, ultimately came to the United States, pioneered the study of vision. He not only pioneered the study of vision, but he gave rise to a phenomenal school of visual physiologists. So Torsten Wiesel and David Tubel, who won the Nobel Prize in 1981, were a student. Margaret Livingston is a direct descendant of David Tubel. And Doris Chow and Winfried Freiwald, that I will tell you about now, is a descendant of Marge Livingston. Chow and Freiwald did this experiment. They imaged the brain of monkeys while they showed them pictures of humans or of monkeys. And they found six areas, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that respond selectively to faces. They call these face patches. So since these were monkeys, they could put electrodes into these cells. And they found that in these patches, 95% of cells respond to faces. In some patches, the frontal view, and some the side view. Moreover, if you stimulate the middle patches, you light up the others. So this is an interconnected system of face processing. It's a marvelous contribution. Recording from one face patch. You show a monkey, a picture of a monkey. Monkeys like that. Brrr, they fire. You show a monkey a cartoon of a monkey. Just like we, they like cartoons even more. Noses are not important in cartoons, presumably because noses don't participate in emotion. The cell fires even more than to a real picture. But it's got to be the complete gestalt. Take out the mouth, no firing. Take out the eyes, no firing. Eyes, mouth, and no circle, no firing. Circle alone, no firing. You gotta have the whole schmear in order to get it. But if you invert it, there's no firing, and if you exaggerate it, fires like mad. Let me just briefly mention to you that each of these other functions can be localized to one or another region of the brain. I'll just quickly mention it to you because I want to focus on one final point. So visual information comes in through the striate cortex. There is a projection to the inferior temporal cortex for facial processing. There's also an area, lateral occipital cortex, where visual and tactile information come together. Why do you think that's important? You often, when you look at a painting, particularly with sculpture, have a physical feeling, like a tactile sensation. In a Soutine painting, if you pile on the paint with kokoschka, you actually have a tactile sensation. There's an area where tactile and visual sensation converge to bring those together and to intensify that sensation. There is an extrastriate body area that responds to the body. There is a motion processing area that responds to motion. A car, a taxi, a bicycle responds to all of that. But what's interesting is there's an area that responds to biological motion. Now, kids with autism have no difficulty at all responding to the bicycle, but they have response with difficulty with biological motion. If you reach out your hand to reach them, they will not respond or they will withdraw. They cannot handle social interactions. There are two areas that are concerned with simulation. These are the mirror neuron areas that you might have heard of Rizzolatti's discovery. When the monkey picks up a glass of water, these cells fire. That's no surprise. This is part of the motor system. But what's surprising is those cells fire when you pick up a glass of water. They respond in empathy and simulation. That was an astonishing surprise. So this is a component that contributes not only to the beholdership, but to everyday life in which we respond to other people's action. And finally, there's a theory of mind area in which we're concerned with actually what is going on in your head, what are your motivations, what are your dreams, what are your aspirations. But I'm going to finish this segment by just pointing out one final thing. Recently, in the last year, profound insights have been gotten into interaction between the amygdala, which is the orchestrator of emotion, and the hypothalamus, which executes emotion. And this explains Judith and Holofernes. David Anderson, a colleague of mine at Caltech, made a wonderful discovery. He found that in the hypothalamus, there are cells that respond to mating. There are also nearby cells that respond to aggression. And fascinatingly, he found 20% of the cells at the border respond to both sex and aggression. This suggests that the circuitry for the two are linked. So there are mating neurons, there are fighting neurons, and there are neurons in between, 20%. How does it work? You can put a molecule called channel rhodopsin into cells and activate them, and you can activate them as a function of intensity. So David Anderson studied this 20%, and he found when you stimulate them weakly, you activate mating. When you stimulate them strongly, you activate fighting. So you see here, on this elementary level, a beginning understanding of Freud, Klimt, Schiele, and the new school of the mind coming together. A beginning explanation of how we could fuse these different tendencies. Obviously, there's much more to it, but this is a beginning. Let me conclude. The greatest enterprise for the human mind has been and always will be the attempt to form linkages between the sciences and humanities, as was done so successfully in Vienna 1900. The Viennese modernists who derived from Rokitansky were among the first toward establishing these linkages in art and science. This pioneering attempt, as you heard before, continued in Vienna and then crashed in March 13, 1938. And I was here to see that crash. A new medical school dean was appointed, Edward Perkov, who had been an illegal Nazi from 1933 on. He was appointed dean on March 15th. And this is the first faculty meeting, April 6, 1938. He had fired about 50% of the faculty, most of whom were Jewish, and the rest responded with Hitler salute as he greeted them at the faculty meeting. So this destroyed forever the Rokitansky Second Vienna School of Medicine. It is gone. What has happened since then? What has happened to the University of Vienna Medical School from 1945, the end of the war, to 2014? There are two periods one can identify. One, the period in which Austria denied it did anything. It said, we were victims. We did absolutely nothing. In fact, the dean of the university, Wolfram Denk, was an established Nazi. Didn't prevent him from becoming head of a great university. This changed in 1991, when a very courageous move, granted, 50 years late, but a courageous move, Franz Vronsky said, we participated. Individuals were fully responsible for the acts of the Holocaust. But I'm pleased to tell you that when he said this in 1991, the medical school was already 1 year ahead. They did not do this immediately, but they put together a document called Expelled Intelligence, in which they listed the senior staff that was dismissed. In 1998, which was, I guess, the 60th anniversary of the Anschluss, they initiated a course in medicine and national socialism, And you pointed out that in the 50th anniversary, they didn't think of doing this. A beautiful plaque honoring the expelled students and teachers is in the inside building of the medical school. And in 2004, under Wolfram Schutz, who had already been dean before that, founding of the Medical University of Vienna. So this is the 10th anniversary of the Medical University of Vienna on the University Ring, not Leuenberger Ring as it's sometimes listed. And we celebrate, I think, three characterizing features that emerges from this new institution. A renaissance, a rebirth of Viennese aspiration for greatness in medicine. It is now rated among the top 15 medical schools in Europe and 49th in the world. This is an amazing accomplishment, much of which has come in the last 10 or 15 years. And the best is still to come, one would hope. Second of all, if you just look around you in this room, you see a return to the Rokitansian ethos, an academic environment in which people accept it based on their intellectual interest and their intellectual excellence, not on their racial or religious origins. A big question, which you will now be able to judge when you look at the exhibition, is will the Medical University of Vienna also lead to new ways of thought? And one possibility is the new exhibition at the Josephinum that you're going to see this evening, and later exhibitions that one could think of, and I've thought of one myself, that could lead to steps in that direction. So I think the best is yet to come. Thank you very much.